Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Guy Harvey has had better luck than Santiago, the old fisherman in Ernest Hemingway's Old Man and the Sea, where Santiago went weeks without catching a fish and spent days wrestling with a massive marlin only to catch and then lose it to the sharks. Harvey has built his successful business over decades, capturing marine life in his art and selling it on T-shirts. Hemingway's tale of fishing and determination, man within nature and eventually redemption, is a story that has resonated with Harvey since his mom gave him the book, he says, when he was 11 or 12 years old, growing up in Jamaica. He says he already was infatuated with the marlin even before reading Hemingway.
I fished with people in Jamaica who fished in small boats with hand lines and caught big fish. When Dad wasn't taking me out on his boat, I would bum a ride with the local guys who were all handline guys, and they go offshore and catch tunas and wahoo and sharks and marlin on handlines. And so I was familiar. This was not a new experience for me.
Hemingway and Harvey share the Gulf Stream and the inspiration that has flowed from it. It was prose for Hemingway. For Harvey, it's paintings and philanthropy and business. Guy Harvey has been drawing and painting sea life since he was a teenager. He was still in his teens when he made dozens of drawings illustrating Hemingway's classic novel. The drawings were first published, finally, in 1990, and the originals are on display at the Custom House in Key West.
Of all the topics that I paint, because it sells very well, is the old man and the big marlin. So everybody knows the story, and it's the most famous fishing story in the world.
Harvey has returned to the marlin probably dozens of times, even more maybe. It's on area rugs, stationery, and of course, T-shirts. Harvey has built a multi-million dollar a year business on his life and love of fish and fishing. It's a business that is as much about commerce as it is about conservation.
The art is the basic building block for everything. And I came upon the sort of art world through pure luck, really.
Today on the Sunshine Economy, we feature a conversation with marine artist, entrepreneur, scientist, and conservationist Guy Harvey. It's difficult not to see his strong vertical and copywritten signature on a T-shirt, hat, or mug when you're near water in South Florida. The signature and the art attached to it has become shorthand for fishing and boating.
My career really began as a fisheries scientist, not as an artist. Combine that with the science, and you have the recipe for a successful wildlife artist, basically.
Harvey has been putting his marine art on T-shirts since 1986, making his first big move into business at the Fort Lauderdale Boat Show. He was a university professor at the time, lecturing in fishery management and painting on the side. He says he wasn't interested in putting his art on T-shirts, but he came around as the technology to put his art on clothing improved.
But to actually have your art on a variety of houseware and garments and stuff like that was totally unacceptable. But I coined the phrase wearable art, Tom. So the whole evolution of four-color process printing, the ability to really do a much better job than just block printing, evolved at the same time. So I was very lucky with the whole evolution of the style and the way we came across. And of course, there was a giant void in that market.
And he has filled that void for more than 30 years. He's still drawing and painting, and that work still is finding its way onto T-shirts and an expanding list of other items. 18 years ago, he returned to his scientific roots by founding the Guy Harvey Research Institute at Nova Southeastern University, and then 10 years ago, the Guy Harvey Ocean Foundation. They are backed by the business of selling the art, and that business is good, driven in part by catching that blue marlin, that same fish Hemingway's Santiago went after.
People who fish aspire to catching a blue marlin. They'd rather wear a blue marlin, even if they live in Minnesota and fish for walleye, than have a walleye or a muskie on their back. And that is a fact.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. Today, it is commerce and conservation. Guy Harvey. I'm Tom Hudson. Fishing and business have some things in common, right? Both take persistence and patience. They both take skill, even some luck. And they demand a sense of optimism. Guy Harvey is optimistic, if he's anything, about the business he has built from his marine life art. He has thrived by taking his drawings from the ocean and putting them on T-shirts and hats and other items.
Business has been great. Business has been great for 32 years when the brand was started back in 1986.
He calls it wearable art. Some may call it coastal living fashion and furnishings. Harvey won't talk about the financials of his business, but he has donated and the business has generated hundreds of thousands of dollars for his nonprofit interests focused on marine research. He has expanded to include his art with branches of the military, colleges and universities, and big sporting events like NASCAR races. But it starts with the art.
We do a lot of direct-to-consumer sales through e-commerce. It's a growing part of our business. And of course, because the art is mine, I control the production of it. It's one of the sort of easiest things to sell via e-commerce. The other licensed items and apparel have done very well traditionally. After 32 years, I started out with T-shirts for Florida and Fort Lauderdale. We went to AFCO in California, and ending that contract next year, we're switching to the Miami-based company Perry Ellis International, which is a big move for us.
This is a contract for licensing his art for apparel. Beginning in January, Guy Harvey T-shirts will be sold by Perry Ellis International under a new deal. Perry Ellis is based in Doral and distributes more than 20 different licensed brands like Penguin, Janssen, and its namesake, Perry Ellis. It's a 5-year deal with an option for another 5 years, says Harvey. It'll put Guy Harvey's art and signature on shirts, fishing, and resort clothes. This gear represents the primary business for Harvey's art, shirts and hats, but he's expanding into accessories and wants to get his art on other products, including home furnishings.
Because the art would do very well, I think, on a variety of licensed items. But apparel will always be the biggest one. My art is unique. I've seen a lot of competition come up in the last 10 years. And part of the problem has been that we have lost a little bit of market share because we haven't been getting ahead of this level of competition.
That competition, is it changing the art? Or
no.
So it's not changing what's on the shirt. Maybe it's changing the design of the shirt?
Somewhat.
Or more, the shape of it, maybe?
No, more to do with the fabric you use.
Fabric.
And I would definitely say that the some of the man-made fabrics have become very desirable, especially in the younger generations.
The polypropylenes and those types of fabrics?
Yeah, what they call performance.
Have you ever given serious consideration to selling the brand, not just licensing, but selling?
I'm too young for that. I'm full of energy. I love painting. I love diving. I love fishing.
Have you had offers to buy the brand?
Nope. And
you wouldn't entertain them if you did?
Not for a while. I'm going strong. So,
The Perry Ellis relationship, Perry Ellis based in Doral, right, here in South Florida, operating globally. And does it come with a guaranteed minimum, for instance?
You have to do that. That's part of the bread and butter of the contract negotiation process.
You're protected on the downside, but you get some upside.
Of course.
Yeah.
That's just business common sense.
Sure.
Yeah.
And a portion of that goes to the philanthropy.
I don't like to give out those figures, but it's substantial.
Okay.
Yeah. Typically, the foundation will raise $1.5 million a year from a variety of different sources. And so the apparel is a big part of that.
In 2015, the licensing revenue that went to the foundation was $1.1 million, according to the tax filing.
Like I say, it takes cash to care. And we're always looking for money. Even though we're pretty good at fundraising. And we have this fantastic relationship with the Florida Lottery and with the specialty license plate program, which is a very good source of constant revenue, because you don't want to be always struggling to raise money from fundraising efforts or depending entirely on your licensees. You want constant streams of income.
As an artist, have there been opportunities you've said no to potential licensing or merchandising opportunities?
A lot, yeah.
For instance?
Everybody thinks that, well, I can get Guy Harvey's art on my product and we're going to make millions. And it doesn't happen, So there are strict regulations and guardrails which we apply to any potential license.
What are those? What are some of those? What's the process that you look through when looking at new merchandising options?
The key thing is they have to have a very good distribution system. we're not even going to touch them if they don't already have a great distribution system in place. If they say they're going to do it, that's a big warning sign. Secondly,
so you're looking for scale, right?
Right away. And where do you sell? Who do you sell to? The second thing is, you know, the quality of the product, the quality of the garments. I always get compliments from the customers about the quality of the garments, the printing, the sort of customer service and all that. It's a very important part of the business people don't figure on. And is it something that you would be prepared to have in your house or on your back, or would you use it yourself? Those are the sort of three main guidelines that I go by.
Are there opportunities away from coastal living for Guy Harvey Enterprises?
I would like to think so. You know, how do you get into the Midwest and into places that are more than 500 miles from the sea? Because there's definitely a sort of resistance inland, even though, you know, Americans travel so much and people from Minnesota will come down to the Keys and buy all the Guy Harvey T-shirts there.
But are you willing to take off the blue marlin and put a muskie or a northern pike?
I've done that. But guess what? People who fish aspire to catching a blue marlin. And so they'd rather wear a blue marlin, even if they live in Minnesota and fish for walleye, than have a walleye or a muskie on their back. And that is a fact. So go with the blue marlin.
Talking with artist, entrepreneur, and marine scientist Guy Harvey. His business is headquartered in Davie with a dozen employees. The licensing agreement with Perry Ellis takes effect in January. It represents his latest effort and biggest effort to break through nationally and internationally in the casual wear clothing market. Harvey expects the deal will help his company grow by more than 10% a year, and 1% of the licensing revenue will go to fund his philanthropy. That's still to come.
I was inspired early on to think about, well, how can I use my experience, my knowledge, and the cash generated to help cast more light on what's happening under the waves.
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. Thanks again for listening and supporting public radio. I'm Tom Hudson. Guy Harvey's art is more often worn, not hung. His watercolors and pen and ink drawings of marlins, mako sharks, and mahi are on T-shirts, hats, and even dog collars. He's been licensing his artwork to put on clothes since the late 1980s. And it is an ever-expanding portfolio. There was the Guy Harvey Florida Lottery scratch-off game a few years ago. There still is the Guy Harvey Specialty Florida License Plate, the Guy Harvey Magazine, television documentaries, and his painting on the bow of a Norwegian cruise line ship. The ship brings together his art, his science interest, and his conservation efforts. Since partnering with Nova Southeastern University in 1999 for the Guy Harvey Research Institute and starting his own foundation a decade ago, Harvey has steered hundreds of thousands of dollars from the sale of his T-shirt art into marine science. The research includes several ongoing projects. They tag and track mako sharks, for instance. 14 years ago, an international group of environmental scientists said the species is vulnerable to extinction. Same for the oceanic white-tip shark, another species Harvey's T-shirt art money helps track. In early 2018, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Fisheries Department officially designated the white tip as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. The federal government estimates the population of the shark has fallen 90% in the Gulf of Mexico. Nova Southeastern and the Research Institute have also put its marine wildlife tracking projects online, allowing people to follow right along with 9 species that have been fitted with satellite tags. The market demand for sharks, especially shark fins, has led to a drop-off in some populations. The Research Institute has used DNA testing to find out that most of the dried shark fins and gills collected at markets in Canada, China, and Sri Lanka were from species banned from international trade because of their low populations. Harvey's research has extended beyond sharks as well. It has also included surveys of Nassau groupers, a fish that is considered critically endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature.
Oceanic research work, Tom, is very expensive. You're dealing with animals that are highly migratory. They live out in the open ocean. They're hard to access. You can't keep them in captivity. So just getting to be with one is expensive. And then you got your team and your film crews and everybody else. So it took a lot of money, a lot of time over many, many years. And as we found, because these animals are also long-lived, to really understand their life cycles, you can't do it for a year or 2 years. You have to invest for 5 to 10 years to study one species. The results have been fascinating.
Your story growing up on the water in Jamaica, conservation comes to you likely naturally. The scientific part of it, the artistic part of it comes to you naturally. You have been successful in marrying that with the business side to fuel the philanthropy.
You know, being a fisheries scientist, you become, and a diver and a fisherman, you become very quickly aware of resource issues. And in Jamaica, a developing country, very large population, a lot of poor people, but easy access to the ocean, and a lot of people spearfished and lived off the sea, subsistence living, really, not a commercial venture. But you multiply the effect of all these people and these mouths to feed over a narrow shelf area, which is what most Caribbean islands don't have, a big shelf area. They have a narrow shelf. And so there's a lot of fishing pressure. And you see in a very short space of time, 5 or 10 years, the effects of overexploitation, both on fish, on coral reefs, and, you know, all nearshore species. And so the degradation is very rapid. And you mix into that all the other things, coastal development, harbor dredging, poor agricultural practices, you know, heavy runoff, stuff like that. You see the degradation taking place very quickly. And so I was inspired early on to think about, well, how can I use my experience, my knowledge, and the cash generated, because it takes cash to care, to help alleviate the system or just cast more light on what's happening under the waves. Because, you know, so little money is spent when you compare money being spent on outer space, for example, Tom, it absolutely drives me crazy. We know so little about what's below the surface. It's like out of sight, out of mind. And so it begs for attention.
How do you balance that attention, that scientific interest that you have, the conservation interest that you have, with the commercial side that generates the resources, the money, to fuel the conservation in a way that doesn't exploit what's happening under the seas?
I get that part. Our ability with Mahmood to choose topics to research now has become, you know, an integral part of where we go, why we go, what are we trying to achieve, and multitasking while we're in the field. And so any one expedition in which, you know, we all go together, we'll be taking a documentary filmmaker. We'll be filming the entire process of research work, whether it's tag deployment or stingray surveys or grouper surveys, whatever we're focused on. We're doing a really cool study in Costa Rica right now on blue marlins, which is very exciting. But we're not only executing the deployment of the science and the technology we're putting on these animals, we're telling the story, but I'm also generating inspiration from being in the field with these animals. And so the art that comes out of these expeditions is can be formidable sometimes.
How so?
Even if I go to the same place time and time again, which I often do, mm-hmm. There are places I go to because you get the best bang for your buck. And so my wife says, why do you keep going back to Panama? So, well, I've been like 65 times, written a book about the place. We fish a lot down there because we get results. And there's a multiplicity of species to study.
By results, you mean what?
We are, if we're shooting a fishing show or a diving show, the prolific seas around Panama, Costa Rica, the eastern tropical Pacific Ocean is very productive. If we're doing billfish tagging, we can tag as many fish in one day that we take a whole year to do in the Caribbean.
How much of that, in your estimation as a scientist, is because of the difference of
the oceanographic systems? Right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. A half century ago, could you have tagged that many fish in the Caribbean?
Perhaps not, because the eastern tropical Pacific is just so much more productive. There are that many more bodies in the water, mm-hmm. And the water is very, very productive compared to the Caribbean and Western Atlantic.
How do you think about that mix of commerce and conservation here? You're smiling because you know where that kind of question is headed. As you're a fisherman yourself, and you talk about the influence of the fishing industries on population of marine life.
And the politics, because fish have become very political.
So it
goes back to wanting to do it in the first place. So I want to do this. I want to give a percentage of our licensing business back to research and education. And there's a method to this madness, Tom, because without data about the species that you're trying to protect, you can't really effectively manage a resource. You're just guessing. So the first part of the whole process is to gather data. And as I mentioned earlier, many of these species that I love, are inaccessible, highly migratory. And so the data gathering process takes a long time. But once you've got that done, you use your data to educate, whether it's fishery managers or school kids or whoever. But using this technique, this process, you can then affect conservation. And you know, here in Florida and all over the southern states, all over America really, conservation is working because you're dealing with a lot of research work has been done, especially on coastal fishes. You've got a fairly well-educated population. You certainly have a vast population that fishes and dives, that uses the ocean, and most of them are well-to-do people just because of the cost of doing that outdoor activity. And so the conservation part of it has worked in large part. And you think of landmark cases where, like in Florida, the banning of gill nets within 3 miles of the shore. That is a giant move toward conservation. The use of circle hooks instead of J hooks. All of these things have come about through science, through experimentation. And so the whole process is working, but it just takes much, much longer than we all thought. And I can tell you some examples of species that have been whacked really hard down to the point of extinction. And bear in mind that often nothing gets done until the last remaining individuals are around and somebody wakes up and says, oh, this is not good. You know, let's put a legal fence around these animals or this place and protect it. And that's happening more and more now.
Both in the United States as well as
and
in
other
the Caribbean?
Yeah. It's taking off.
Because it's a shared ocean.
It is. It's a commonality that joins all of us. I love to quote the story of the Nassau groupers in Cayman, because throughout the Caribbean, they have been overfished throughout their range because they have this, along with the snappers, this weakness of all spawning in the same place at the same time of year. And guess what? It worked for millions and millions of years until we came along.
Until the fishermen figured out where that was.
And they figured it out. And in the last 50, 80 years, they've annihilated all these stocks to the point where Nassau groupers are commercially extinct. But in Little Cayman, they found an active spawning aggregation site. It was fished. The guys killed 2,000 or 3,000 fish a year out of it. Then the government said, that's enough, and put protections around the sites. And then the combination of research, protection, education, and we did not one but two documentaries about how it's working. Over 15 years, that spawning aggregation has bounced back to what it was almost in the mid to early 2000s, I would say, which is a tremendous recovery. But it's taken 15 years to get this far. And we're all looking at each other like it should have taken 5 or 6 years.
So does that give you hope? As a marine biologist, on the other hand, does it concern you, knowing the commercial pressures on those populations?
Yes, and this is where it has to be a multi-pronged approach. You're going to have protections, more protected areas. In fact, the whole basis of one of our projects, the Caribbean Challenge Initiative, is to try and get different countries to have 20% of their nearshore waters protected by the year 2020, which was a reachable goal 10 years ago, but a lot of countries aren't doing it. More and more politicians are realizing the value of living animals and living reefs to their island economies, especially Florida, because, you know, we're surrounded on three sides by water here. The value of nature to the socioeconomic well-being of just about anywhere is now being highlighted tremendously.
That's artist, fisherman, and entrepreneur Guy Harvey. He dedicates a portion of his sales from his merchandise licensing toward marine research. Now, still to come, we'll continue our conversation about mixing commerce and conservation.
The economics of it, if you know nothing else, you don't care about the biology of the animals or how, what they look like or how many there are or how often they reproduce, a living animal is much more worthwhile to you and your economy and, of course, the ecosystem than a dead animal.
We're back on the Sunshine Economy today on WLRN, Commerce and Conservation, a conversation with Guy Harvey. For more than 30 years, Guy Harvey has navigated between the worlds of art, business, and science. He was an artist before he was a scientist, and he was a business entrepreneur before he was a philanthropist. But he was a fisherman first. He grew up in Jamaica, tracing his English-Jamaican heritage back 10 generations on the island. He grew up drawing what he would see on and in the Caribbean Sea, yellowfin tuna, sea turtles, tarpons, and of course, marlins. His company has signed on to the Caribbean Challenge, an effort for the Caribbean nations to protect 20% of their shore and nearshore waters by 2020, an ambitious enough goal when it was first launched in 2008. Harvey doesn't mind putting a price on conservation. He thinks it helps, especially for policymakers making decisions balancing protections of the natural world with marketplace profit motives.
And you can actually put dollar values on individual animals if you want.
It ties directly commerce with conservation. Harvey did just that close to his home in the Cayman Islands at Stingray City. It's a sandbar where stingrays gather, and so do about 1 million tourists a year. They swim right alongside and feed the rays. The experience has changed the rays' behavior, making them daytime feeders instead of nighttime eaters. It has also led to more protections for the rays.
We reckon every stingray there generates about $500,000 a year.
Each stingray,
each
a
stingray.
Half a million U.S. dollars.
And
that's in hospitality, tourism, taxes.
All the benefits, all the accessory activities that go with a visit to a place like that. They're long-lived animals. Some will live 50, 60 years. But just say they live for 20 years, that's $10 million that they've generated. And so I went through four successive ministers of the environment to say, hey, you've got to protect these animals. You can't let the abuse that's happening to them happen. You need to put a legal fence around them. And it took me 13 years to get that done.
Do you think you could make that same argument for marine life in the United States?
Absolutely. There are basically two user groups. There are people who fish for marine life, and there are people who want to look at marine life. And the perfect example is sharks. Sharks are they're shy animals. They've been, you know, really mistreated, ill-treated, maligned over decades. There are some places where there are some in some sort of reasonable abundance, like in the Bahamas, for example. A lot of shark diving goes on there. I call it shark ecotourism. And again, you can apply a dollar value to individual species, whether it's a tiger, a lemon, a nurse shark, or Caribbean reef shark, whatever species you're looking at. 28, 30 years ago, the Bahamas banned longline fishing in their archipelago. That's a big step forward. Any kind of fishing like that, using traps or lines or indiscriminate fishing, is bad for whatever resource you're trying to get. So the sharks survive because they ban longline fishing. Well, guess what? Shark diving, shark ecotourism picked up. So they protected sharks back in 2011. And so shark ecotourism generates about $120 million a year now for the Bahamian economy without killing a single animal. And shark ecotourism in Florida now has taken off. I remember seeing a figure quoted, $220 million generated in 2016 through shark ecotourism activities. Mm. And again, $1 million generated from the sale of shark fins in that same time. And how many sharks were killed for $1 million worth of shark fins? So the economics of it, if you know nothing else, you don't care about the biology of the animals or what they look like or how many there are or how often they reproduce, to a guy making a decision, it should be very obvious that a living animal is much more worthwhile to you and your economy and, of course, the ecosystem than a dead animal.
Let me ask you about the ecosystem in which that marine life is living. Here in Florida, in the last several months, that has been brought back acutely in focus. The blue-green algae, right. Phosphorus-laden water out of Lake Okeechobee and the discharges right. to the east and west, and then, of course, the red tide in the Gulf Coast for a year now, which has made itself around the peninsula onto the East Coast. As you've been watching this as a conservationist, as a businessman who financial fortunes are tied to marine life in multiple different ways, and looking at it from the Caribbean, not from the mainland U.S., how do you see this?
It's very political. And it can be solved very easily, especially the outflows from Lake Okeechobee. People know what to do. It's just a matter of getting it done. The red tides, however, are more complex because there are natural occurrences. And we have a similar, if not worse, situation in the Caribbean to deal with, which is the proliferation of sargassum mm-hmm. and that washing up on our beaches and in our marinas and then decomposing and smelling really awful. It doesn't have the same killing effect that the red tide has had on killing fish and marine mammals and stuff like that. But it's still very unsightly. It's expensive to move. It's costing tourism dollars for sure. And people can't figure out why it's become so prolific. There are all sorts of theories about the African dust blowing across, landing in the Central Atlantic, fertilizing the sargassum, and it multiplies prolifically. And, of course, it's moved by the currents, and it affects a much, much, much greater area than the red tides do.
Yeah. And while it's important scientifically to understand the causes of all that, the immediate concern, of course, is the commerce.
Of course.
The loss of commerce yep. that this represents. Yep. Here in South Florida, you know, as we move on into the tourist season, whether or not those tourists from up north in the United States or Europe or Latin America see those headlines about red tide on beaches in South Florida, and the same goes for the sargassum yep. in the Caribbean. So how do you, as a longtime conservationist and businessman, how do you continue to talk about this and to address this in a way that's productive?
I think it's important to try and set goals, even small goals, and try and reach them and make a difference that way. We certainly have done that at the GHRI. Some of the work we've done on sharks in particular. And I keep going back to sharks, Tom, because, you know, we talk about all the other ills that are happening to the planet, but the rate of removal of sharks in the last three decades through the shark fin trade has been with lightning speed. I mean, talk about, you know, people talk about climate change and warming water and acidification, but this is happening so fast that we really have to do something about it. And we can do it right now by just drying up the demand. But also we want to learn more about the animals. So the work we've done on Mako sharks, and we've become a world leader in Mako shark research work. The Mako, for your listeners, is like a cousin to the white shark, mm-hmm. The fastest of all the sharks. It's the predator of all the other oceanic predators. Mm-hmm. They eat tunas, they eat marlin, they eat swordfish.
It's at the top of the food chain.
They are. They're an amazing creation, to be honest with you. A beautiful animal to paint as well. Well, they happen to taste good. And so people don't release them. They may catch a tiger shark or a black tip or a Caribbean reef shark and release it, but nobody releases Mako sharks because they taste good. And so up and down the coast, from Newfoundland down to Florida. So we did a lot of work on tracking, and we put out, in fact, just 2 weeks ago, our 100th tag went out on Mako sharks. And bear in mind, these tags are like $3,000 each, so that's not a small chunk of change we spent on this research work.
You have spent tens of thousands of dollars through your foundation on this.
I think on the Mako sharks alone, we've gone over $700,000 in 6 years. So with these highly sophisticated tags, we track where the animals go, but of course they get killed. And over 30% of our animals, the tags end up on land. And when the tag is on land, you say, uh-oh, he's dead.
What does that tell you?
He's dead.
But how did he or she get that way?
Sometimes we find out, sometimes we get the tag back. And generally it's through commercial fishing activities, some recreational. But 30% mortality rate, Tom, is unacceptable. It is unsustainable. It is 10 times higher than any previous figure that NOAA generated doing their research work. And how do we get this data? Because it's what you call fishery independent. We're not relying on the people doing the fishing to give us the information. And so
you're relying on the sharks to get the information.
There you are. But the mortality rate is what you're trying to get a figure of. If the foxes are guarding the hen house, you're not going to get the accurate detail about how many hens are left, you know? So this has already made a change. So that has happened with the tiger sharks, with the mako sharks, with oceanic white tips, with groupers, and many other species that we're working on.
What do you think your research around sharks, mako sharks and others, can tell us about the economy of the environment and frankly, the economic consequences of what has happened to these populations?
Again, another great question. There are many species that are well regulated. I touched on that earlier, both recreationally fished and commercially fished. Salmon in the Northwest are very well regulated. There's sustainable fishing there too. I'm not against fishing. I'm against overfishing. And I tell everybody that. I'm not a tree hugger. I love to fish myself. And when I'm marlin fishing, I release all the marlins we catch. But if we catch a nice mahi or a wahoo or something, it's coming in the boat because they're sustainably fished. They're not overfished. So, people ask me, well, what kind of fish do you like to eat? I love to eat salmon. I like yellowfin tuna. But I also like tilapia, you know, a farm food.
Farm food, yeah.
And so this is the other part of the sort of possible solutions, Tom, is to get better at fish farming. And people are. The technology is really increasing now where both for shrimp and for fin fish, with better conversion ratios and feeding less animal protein and more plant products to all these different fish. And you want to choose a fish that is really indestructible. And tilapia are indestructible. They survive all kinds of temperature variations, oxygen level variations. They can breathe air, and they taste good. And they grow everywhere. And so these are the opportunities. These are the options that are before us. And once implemented, they will take the pressure off the wild animals. And you think about all the food that we eat, you know, the chickens, the beef, the lamb, the whatever it is, all the veggies, it's all grown, it's all farmed. And here we are still harvesting wild fish. It's something's wrong there.
Would you support more significant bans on commercial fishing, especially, and sport fishing as it exists here in Florida?
No, not on sport fishing, because sport fishing, for the most part, is very sustainable. Sure, you're going to get some mortality. If you don't want to kill fish, don't go fishing. There's going to be some mortality, which is acceptable. Fishing in America is extremely well regulated for all species. It's just that some are more popular than others. And so, you know, you want to hopefully bring back these species that have been overexploited to a point where they can start to be fished again, but in a more sustainable way than they were in the past. We all face the same problems. You got stayover visitors, you got cruise ship visitors. The Caribbean has millions and millions of people a year coming to all these different islands. And, of course, everybody wants to eat seafood when they get there. Oh, I'll have the local conch. I'll have the local lobster. I'll have the local snapper. Well, they don't exist anymore.
They're not local anymore. If somebody's telling you
Well, that's it.
They're selling you something else.
All these islands historically could sustain their own population. But you add the visitor to the mix, and all of a sudden, you know, you can't sustain it anymore. You have to import the fish. And you know, why do people come to places? I say Cayman, where I live for 20 years. We have no mountains. We have no rivers. It's a tiny little island, 20 miles long. And all we have is the beautiful ocean that comes by. And I say to all the people who run the tourism department and the ministry and all that, and that there's a big controversy right now, Tom, because they want to build a cruise ship dock in the middle of Georgetown Harbor, which is a marine park. And it's like, we already have 1.9 million cruise shippers already without a dock, just FYI. It's like, why do people come to Cayman? They come here because of the water. They want to be either on it, in it, or beside it, and they want to see the animals that live in it. So why would you do anything to affect the quality of that experience?
You're clearly against that kind of development in the Caymans.
I am, because we don't need it, and there's no justification for that. Especially as it's, you know, some of the unforeseen issues that might happen down the road, oceanographically or geologically. We have a very good stayover presence. We're building a brand new airport, which is going to help alleviate the problems a lot. We've always been a niche destination. And I say we can't compete with Mexico and Jamaica and the Dominican Republic and all these places that cater to a mass market. And what happens to all your coral reefs and your fish when you introduce so many more people? And then what are they going to do? There are no attractions. The Stingray City that we have guarded so jealously, and we've done all this work for 19 years at the Stingray City, my foundation has, it can't take any more people. So where are you going to put all these people when you got them here?
That's artist and businessman Guy Harvey. Now, this highlights the balance Harvey has to strike between the commerce of his art and the conservation he hopes it draws attention to. He may oppose building a cruise ship here in Georgetown Harbor in Grand Cayman, where he lives, but he has partnered with cruise company Norwegian Cruise Lines, putting his marine life art on the hull of a ship and featuring his video documentaries on an onboard video channel. He also sails on that ship himself for a week-long conservation cruise.
It was a way to have a moving billboard traveling the Caribbean, extolling the aesthetic beauty of these animals, but also telling a little bit about the life history.
It's interesting. Let's explore this a little bit, where you're resistant to the cruise industry coming into the Caymans in a very purposeful, bigger way. But
no, I'm not.
You're
I'm
not.
I'm not resistant. I'm resistant to them building a dock.
Fair enough.
No, they come in and they get tendered. And so they, some anchor, and you know that piece of reef there has been dug up for the last 50 years. But going back to what Norwegian and probably other cruise ships are going to be doing is they're building their ships very sophisticated nowadays. You know, the whole issue about stuff going overboard, sewage, garbage, leftover food, all that, that's all gone away. Norwegian just announced they're not going to use plastic straws anymore, which is it's a big first step. Jamaica, last week I was down there for a fishing tournament, they announced that they're going to ban all plastic bags and plastic generally. And these are big steps that have been taken not only by individual operations, companies, but also by countries. And the whole issue of plastic in the ocean is a giant issue, Tom, that we have to get a hold of.
Has this intersected with your licensing and merchandising?
But yes, we've tried to get shirts made using recycled plastic and stuff like that. And people buy them. They're more expensive, but people do buy them.
The market's there for them.
It definitely is.
And do you see that as a new avenue, item for you?
Yeah.
And what's been the response on the retail side of it, the folks that are selling that merchandise?
Again, they're always looking for their margins, Tom. So, you know, if they can make money, they're going to be happy.
If they can retain their margin, yeah, they're okay with it.
Yeah, it's all about the margins.
Guy Harvey speaking with us about his mix of art, business, and marine conservation. Still to come, whether that pursuit of profit margins has affected his artistic process.
I don't have anybody painting for me. And a lot of people ask me that question. Sure. And I find it actually a mind-boggling question. Why would I have somebody else paint my paintings for me?
Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Today we're featuring a conversation with artist, environmentalist, and entrepreneur Guy Harvey. If you spend any time in or around the ocean in South Florida, you likely will come across one of his paintings on a t-shirt and his sharp vertical printed signature. He has been drawing and painting sea life since he was a child, but he's made a business out of it over the past 30 years. And in 2019, he has a new licensing deal with Perry Ellis International based in Doral. It is his biggest licensing partner yet to sell shirts, hats, and other items with his growing list of marine life art.
You've painted scores of marine life. Is there something that you haven't painted that you want to, but for some reason you haven't been able to put it on paper?
I have not been to the Antarctic or the Arctic, and that is a serious ecological area that I would like to go and see some animals there to paint some animals. Because, Tom, I pretty much say to myself, you can't paint it unless you've seen it or had it in your hand, because I'm all about authenticity. And so that's a big gap for me. When I was expanding this business, just to get into the Pacific, was a big deal for me because I'd never been to the Pacific. Whether it's the Eastern Pacific, where we do a lot of game fishing, or Central like Hawaii, or the Western Pacific to the Great Barrier Reef. These are all necessary expeditions I did to gain first-hand knowledge so I could paint authentically what I wanted to paint. So to answer your question, the Arctic and the Antarctic are two big gaps.
Have you changed your artistic process as the business has taken off?
I don't think so. I found that the watercolor and pen and inks work really well for the T-shirt art. It was a special style that I developed with a lot of hard lines, just because in transferring the art from paper to a material, I wanted there to be, you know, a very good lifelike representation of my art. Nowadays, and this is before you had all these computer derivatives, and nowadays we have a stable of graphic artists that can do anything with my art, which is fine. I don't mind the manipulation.
But are you still the originator?
Absolutely. No, I don't have anybody painting for me. And a lot of people ask me that question, sure. And I find it actually a mind-boggling question. Why would I have somebody else paint my paintings for me?
Are you disciplined in your creativity?
Very. Yeah.
How? What's that process like? Is it every day?
Every day. Yep. In the old days, when I was, you know, a lot more energetic, I'd aim for 10 hours a day painting, and
that doesn't leave a whole lot of time for fishing.
Well, that's the weekends are for that, you see. So or expeditions. I would actually save my time up. You know, you work for 30 or 40 days straight, and then go on a binge to Costa Rica, Cocos Island, or Panama or Venezuela or some of these places, and just go and do it and have great fun and come back fully energized, full of inspiration for the next piece. So, no, I mean, my wife will tell you how many weekends I've worked at home and just avoided going out, and because there are deadlines as well.
Set by the business.
Of course.
By your business partners.
Yeah.
They need the new designs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So very, very disciplined. And I keep a log of all my work, not only a journal, but everything is photographed electronically so that we can use it for whatever we want. That, of course, has changed because my library is so vast. A lot of the art now that I did 20 years ago is appearing on apparel or on coffee mugs or something. And it's very gratifying to see that it's now really ageless.
Marine artist, businessman, and conservationist Guy Harvey. You can follow us on Twitter, at WLRN is our handle. Look for a podcast of all of our programs by searching Sunshine Economy on iTunes. Pilar Ribe is our technical director. Polly Landis, our booking producer. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.